A federal appeals court upholds Rhode Island's magazine ban. Plus, a conversation with the head of the self-defense brigade doing armed patrols in dangerous parts of Hartford, Connecticut. That and more on this episode of the Weekly Reload Podcast.
No, the devil's got no hold on me.
Ooh. Ooh. All right, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another episode of the Weekly Reload Podcast. I'm your host, Stephen Gutowski. I'm also a CNN contributor and the founder of TheReload.com, where you can head over and sign up for our free newsletter today if you want to keep up to date with what's going on with guns in America. Send out our free newsletter once a week. It's a low commitment thing. We don't flood your inbox. And of course, if you want to support our reporting, keep us independent, you can buy a membership today as well to help us continue our work here. You'll get exclusive access to hundreds of pieces of analysis that you won't find anywhere else. This week, we are talking with an activist up in Hartford, Connecticut, about plans, about walks that he's been doing recently. We have Cornell Lewis, who's the founder of the Self-Defense Brigade, with us. Welcome to the show, Cornell. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Can you just give us a little bit of background on the Self-Defense Brigade, exactly what it is for people who might not have heard of you yet?
In Hartford, I organized the Self-Defense Brigade in order to help people in the community with certain issues. For the last 5 years or so, we provided hand-to-hand combat training and strategies and legal armed security for Black Lives Matter protesters. In Connecticut, we have a contingent of neo-Nazis and other types of people that threatened us occasionally. So I helped the people to form security brigades so that when they went out, they were disciplined, they were legally armed, and they knew how to fight. And so that is what we did. And we trained people every week or two in various places, including the LGBT community, and included them in the security forces.
Hmm. Okay, so this is something that started back around 2020.
It has been going on longer than that, but for a while we did it on the down low. We trained people all over Connecticut. So the first thing we did was to teach people the principles of hand-to-hand combat. I'm a fourth degree black belt, and I fought in martial arts competitions for 10 years. And so I taught people how to fight Muay Thai style. I showed people my specialty, which was Brazilian jiu-jitsu grappling. And then I taught people what my teachers taught me, many of whom were Green Berets, how to fight in close. I taught them strategy about going out, knowing how to get into a location, how to get out of a location, where the exits were, how to have extra cars around when you get ready to get out in case it got hectic, and things of that nature.
Okay. And since that time, when you were doing more Black Lives Matter focused stuff, it seems like you've branched out into community violence prevention, essentially with these latest marches that you've done over the last year or two in Hartford. I know there was just one recently that's gotten some news attention where you went with a group of activists and walked the streets in some of the neighborhoods that have had issues with violence and even murder recently. Can you tell us a little bit about that aspect?
Well, the people in Hartford, in the north end of Hartford, that is basically a black, brown, Latino, Latina, and African community. And the people feel as if they are not getting the proper resources from the political machine, which is basically a democratic machine. And so people know of the Self-Defense Brigade. They know of them. They know me. And they know that we've been working tirelessly in the community for a while. So they contacted me to help them form strategies so that they could patrol their community, armed and unarmed, and how to get rid of negative elements in the community, because around 1993 or 94, they watched me and some other men and women go from block to block in the north end of Hartford and shut down the gangs and get rid of the drugs and the crime. And it wasn't pretty. And we did things that the police couldn't do, but people remember it was successful. And we shut down large areas of Hartford where there was drug dealing and other criminal activity going on. So the people contacted us and asked to have something in place that they could use. So I proposed legal armed security patrols. And that is what we're doing now. People go out, they patrol, they're in a group, they're disciplined, and they do what they feel is necessary, because at this point in time, they don't seem to be getting any relief from the politicians or the other people like the NAACP and some other anti-violence groups that claim to be speaking for the people.
All right. So walk us through a little bit of what these marches, these patrols look like. You said, you know, you do stuff that police can do. What does that mean?
Well, they look like this. You get a number of people together like we did Saturday. Many of them were already trained with me and have been with me 3-4 years. So I was really speaking to the new people. So what we do is we explain what we want when we go out and patrol. We don't want any Wild Wild West acts. We don't want people pulling their guns unnecessarily. We try to defuse all potential problems. But if we are attacked, we will defend ourselves. And the only person given the order is me. And if I think we're going to be hurt, then I will give the order. Other than that, we go out disciplined. We have people taking the front, the point. We have people bringing up the rear. We have people on the east and on the west. And in the environment, 30, 40 yards from us, we have men and women in automobiles that only I know of where they are. And they have long guns, shotguns, AR-15s. And if I give the signal, that's the cleanup crew. They come in and they cut off any potential enemies that we might have. And so that's basically how we do it. We go out, we're disciplined, we in formation. And Saturday, I had a whistle. And I told the people, if you hear the whistle, fall back to the church. We had a rear guard that makes sure that if our enemies are in front, that the people in the back can get to the church. And we had the rest of the armed people ready to escort the people back to the church. The rear guard, we are expendable. Our job is to make sure everybody gets back safely. And so that's what I explained to the people. They said, okay. And then we left the church. We had 100 people in the church learning about legal armed carry and what's needed to get a license. We had 30 people out there marching with us. Half of those people were legally armed with more than one gun.
Hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, that's obviously, you know, pretty drastic action you're having to take here. You have, like I think you alluded to earlier, received criticism from the mayor and from some gun control groups, or there's a group called Moms United Against Violence that's criticized these marches that you're doing. Why do you feel compelled to undertake this sort of action, why not, you know, go unarmed or have a community watch, neighborhood watch, like more traditional style? What is it that you think is, making this necessary?
If the Second Amendment allows us to carry legal weapons, why can't we do that? So when people say, why do you have to be armed? I say, why not? We're legal. We're under control. We've been doing this for a while. And, you know, it's interesting. Nobody said anything when we were out in the suburbs marching and they knew we were legally armed. And the neo-Nazis were calling us names and saying things. And the Proud Boys showed up at one rally. And I said, if you threaten us or attack us, we're going to defend ourselves. That was in the front, on the front page of the Hartford Courant. Saw me shaking hands with one of the Proud Boys. And I said, if you attack us, we're going to defend ourselves. I said, capiche? And the guy said, capiche. But now there was no hue and cry about that. But as soon as we come back to the city and we implement the same thing, now there's a hue and a cry. So I say this, why not carry weapons? Why not be able to defend ourselves? The Democrats, the Democratic machine in Hartford is more worried about us carrying guns. And as the mayor said, Cornell and those other people invited a Republican, exact words, in the CT Insider newspaper. A Republican, a conservative, to come and address the people about gun control. Well, this man that they're talking about, Attorney Craig Fishbein, used to be the head of the Firearms Review Board. He's a state senator. He's an accomplished lawyer. So who better to talk about guns and safety and what you need to do than the man who used to be the head of the Firearms Review Board? But see, they're concerned about those things. So some people may see it as being drastic, but I don't. The oppressed, historically, all over the world, choose their method of fighting oppression. As my Irish brothers tell me that are with us, you can't start a fight mine and then tell me how to finish it. And so we say the same thing. You know, we have the right to dictate and organize what it is that we want to do in terms of freeing ourselves from oppression. Sophocles wrote this, "Heaven will never help a man who will not help himself." And we're helping ourselves using the limited resources that we have. And so we think this is the best method, because the other methods that they've thrown at us don't seem to work. The politicians are talking, they're not doing anything, and the people are tired of it.
And, I haven't read any, I've read a number of news reports. Obviously, these marches didn't just start happening this month. You've done them in the past as well. There's reports on them from last year. Have you had any run-ins with law enforcement? Has there been anyone who's from your group that's gotten in trouble over this?
Last year, we had a similar march on Barber Street, starting at a place called Unity Plaza, a scene of crime and shootings. The police showed up there. And before the march, they said Cornell Lewis and the Self-Defense Brigade and other people are going to cause more problems for the Hartford Police Department. Mm-hmm. They said that publicly.
Right.
For some reason, this time, either they don't want to speak about it or Almighty God has silenced their voice. They've been asked four times about our march and what they think about it even before it began. Each time they said, no comment, no comment, no comment, no comment. So the police have not really commented on this. the new mayor of Hartford, he has commented on it. He has called us George Zimmerman wannabes. He has said that we need to seek a spiritual solution. He said, I asked myself, what would Jesus do? Well, he's asking the wrong man about that. I went to theological school to study the New Testament in Greek and Old Testament some in Hebrew. And I'll tell him directly what Jesus would do. Jesus went into the synagogue, which represented the community in the New Testament. Inside the synagogue, there was a demon. All the disciples were there. Either the disciples didn't see the demon or they couldn't get the demon out. Jesus got the demon out of the synagogue. So the man needs to understand, if he's asking what would Jesus do, the historical Jesus, you know, I would say that Jesus would be out in the community rallying the people with the same scripture. Come unto me, all ye that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Or if you're a Muslim, you know, the Prophet Muhammad, I believe, said this, a man who desires peace must be prepared for war. That is what the holy ones would say and would do in response to the mayor of Hartford. So the police, they've kept quiet about this, but the NAACP, the mayor, the governor said he doesn't want this to occur. And I don't know of any other way to say this, so I'm just going to say it. The black people in the community that have been trotted out to speak for the anti-violence groups, they are parroting what they've been told. The black anti-violence groups that get money from Washington, they are out advocating against this like they've been given a mandate from heaven. Now, I notice that the advocates for the anti-violence groups that are basically white have kept quiet. They've trotted out black people to speak against us vociferously, or as my English teacher would say, in a stentorious type fashion, okay? And so all of that is going on behind the scenes. But as my granddaddy from Georgia said, you throw a stick into a pack of dogs, the one that hollers, the one that got hit.
Well, but bottom line, I guess, you'll skip back to my question there. There was haven't been any arrests from anyone from your group. You haven't,
no arrest.
Nothing you've done is illegal as far as I can tell, right? That's correct?
No, there hasn't been any arrests. The police continue to say that they are going to do things in the area to make it safe. We'll see.
Yeah. And have you had any run-ins with, people that you're marching against, you know, these sort of people who are committing the murders and the violence in Hartford?
We have seen a decrease in the level of criminal activity on Garden Street since we've been out there. As a matter of fact, we're going back out there Sunday night at 8 p.m. We have day patrols on the down low, and then we're going to go out there at night, and we'll be out there at night. But the criminal elements are agitated.
But this is something that you're planning to keep up with, that you're going to continue to do these. What is your long-term plan, I guess, with this project?
My long-term plan is to equip the people with a different strategy that they might embrace that will allow them to do what they think is necessary to safeguard their community. That is my long-term goal. And the Self-Defense Brigade will continue to do things that will help the people. The marches that we went on for 5 years, we have not suffered one attack by anybody because we had a plan and we were unified. People saw that and they're asking us for help. So the long-term plan for me is to equip people with the necessary tools and strategies to fight and to continue to train people in hand-to-hand combat in the community. And so they're equipped and then they can modify what we teach them to fit their own needs.
Now, is the hope that you get to a point where you no longer need to do the marches, you know, where it's not necessary anymore?
Well, yes. The people, I'm not going to be out there each and every time with the people. However, the time may come when they will no longer need to do this. And they might be able to come up with something else. But for right now, this seems to be working for them. And it seems to have gotten enough attention to where the power structure knows that people like yourself and other people nationally are watching. And so they're trying to make it seem as if they're doing something, whether they really want to do it or not, we don't know. But you know what? We're not going to wait on them. We're not going to listen to what they say. We're not listening to the Democrats. We're not listening to the religious leaders. We're not listening to the NAACP. We're going to do this ourselves because we see that you can't or you won't. It doesn't seem as if the government wants to protect us, and it doesn't seem as if the police can protect us. So what do you want us to do? We're not going to wait on you. If we wait on you, we're going to be in a world of trouble. So if we succeed or if we fail in this venture, as the old spiritual goes, nobody's fault but mine. Nobody's fault but mine. If I die and my soul be lost, nobody's fault but mine.
And can you tell us a little bit more about these training programs that you're working in the community? How do they work? You know, what are you teaching people beyond you know, the hand-to-hand fighting? You know, what kind of firearms training are you offering? And if people want to get involved who are local to Hartford, how can they do that?
Well, what we do is we get people who are qualified in instruction about guns and safety. We get them to come and teach, you know, the people. And we show them places where they can go and train. Also, what we're doing is getting people to understand that in a fight, whoever stands with you, that's your brother and your sister. So we're getting people through education classes to move beyond how a person looks and what they think, what their religion is, what their sexual orientation is, because in an alley when you're fighting, whoever stands with you, that's your brother and that's your sister. And so part of the education classes tries to get people away from this notion that people have to look like you in order to help you with the fight. Because historically, if you see the social dynamic of people movements, there are all kinds of people that have been involved in revolutions and social unrest and social upheavals. So that's part of the education, is to get people to learn about weapons, how to handle it safely, how to get one, and also the dynamics of what it takes to fight and fight effectively. And then the last thing we're trying to teach people is this. You're not going to convince anybody that you're serious unless you're willing to sacrifice. You have to be willing to sacrifice in this movement. That means if you have to die in order to promote your cause, then that is what you do. That is what the Roman soldiers did in the legions of Caesar. They signed a document in Latin called the Sacramentum. It was a document that bound their lives and their family and their possessions to Caesar. And so it was necessary to do what Caesar wanted, not what they wanted. So in this fight, if you're serious, then you need to sign some kind of document with yourself saying, I'm willing to do more than just run my mouth. I'm willing to do more than just march. If this is important to you, as you claim, you must be willing to lay down your life. Then, and only then, will those that you oppose look at you and say, they have nothing to lose. What can we do?
And you've talked a lot about history here during this interview. I wonder how you view the self-defense organization that you're working with, with sort of historical movements that may be similar in nature. You know, you said you're not a vigilante, right? That this is not a vigilante movement. You're not trying to go out and arrest people or what have you. This is a self-defense oriented thing. How do you place yourself in sort of similar American movements? Do you see yourself akin to Deacons of Defense, the armed group that would provide security for civil rights movements, or even, Ida B. Wells, and her writings on armed self-defense? How do you view yourself and this movement?
Well, it's interesting. People keep throwing that word of vigilante around. Most people don't know that vigilante, the idea started in San Francisco around the 1800s when the businessmen there wanted to protect their business from cowboys shooting up the town. So they hired people to come in and do that to take care of it. And then later it morphed into something else. So most people throw those words around. They don't even know how the thing started. We're not vigilantes or practicing vigilanteism. You know, that's something that the Democrats are throwing out to try to cloud the issue and make us seem as if we need to be demonized. I view myself historically, and the people that are with me, we view ourselves as right in line with people that have always stepped to the forefront in social movements, upheavals, and revolutions. In London, a lady by the name of Boudica stepped forward to fight the Romans. Okay, and so here we have an example of a woman leading people to fight against oppression. Other social movements in France, there were people who stepped forward during the Great Terror and the Revolution in France to fight. Oppressed people all over the world have taken up self-defense in order to protect themselves. So what we're doing is not out of the norm. As a matter of fact, historically, in America, Black people, when they came to this country or were brought here against their will, for the first 200 years, our first God was not Jesus. Our first God was self-defense. And for 200 years, there were revolts in America. In New Amsterdam, before it was New York, in 1811, in Louisiana, there was an uprising. And of course, we know about Nat Turner's rebellion, but there were many, many more. And so what we're doing is not out of the norm for Black people. If it was not for us defending ourselves in America, we might not be here. The Red Summer of 1917, 1918, Black men came back from France. They knew how to shoot. They saw that people would die. And when they came back and went on the plantation and the boss man said, do this, and they said, well, wait a minute, boss, then they weren't going back to doing what they were doing before. They took up their arms and defended themselves. And so culturally speaking, what we're doing with the self-defense brigade as Black and brown people is right in line with what we did the first 200 years that we came to this country. I don't see self-defense as something that is a bad word. I don't see armed self-defense as something that is negative. And I think the people who try to propose that are trying to put forth what I call revisionist history about how Black people survived, how other oppressed people survived all over this earth from the time of Rome, plebes against patricians, up until this point now.
And a lot of that, perhaps understandably, with the level of violence that Hartford has seen, you've got almost like a warlike metaphors throughout much of this interview. Do you see hope for, the communities moving beyond that state of like violence into something where there's more reconciliation?
Wait, hold on a minute. I heard you say something about violence. What? I didn't hear that last word.
Yeah, no, it's, a lot of these metaphors that you're using are obviously, warlike situations that you're referring to. And the violence in Hartford has been pretty elevated and perhaps understandable that that's how things are viewed right now in the community. But are you hopeful that you could move beyond that phase through these sorts of actions to get to a more peaceful stage in Hartford in the future?
Well, I don't see what we're doing as not meaningful. I don't see it as warlike. I see it as the oppressed determining what they feel is necessary for their own liberation. Mm-hmm. And people want to depict it as warlike. But again, the people who are in power are the ones who are attempting to characterize us in those fashions. If we were singing, "We Shall Overcome," if we were praying, if we were holding hands, singing Kumbaya, if we were rubbing our rosary beads, they would say, "Cornell's a great man." But now, I'm warlike. I'm demonizing. I'm riling up the masses to do different things. Well, wait a minute. If you did your job like you should, we wouldn't be doing this right now. So these are not violent ideas. This is not warlike language. It is the language of the oppressed. And again, those in power have no right whatsoever to tell us how to fight. Many of these people that are running their mouth, they don't live in that neighborhood. They are talking from afar where it's safe. Eden-like atmosphere, manicured lawns, things of that nature. And we're catching hell right here in these neighborhoods because of what's going on. So they can say whatever they want to say, and they can keep saying it. But I tell you plainly now, and I tell them, it doesn't make any difference what you say or do. I'm going to ram the agenda of the people down your throat, and I'm going to make you like it.
So you see this more as like a lifestyle of armed self-defense, and while it's maybe effective for lowering these violence that you're seeing in Hartford, it's not necessarily something that's only to be used in a state of emergency, but it's more of a lifestyle in your opinion. Is that what you're getting?
Well, people can use this, and then all things evolve. All things take another step. I play conga drums, bongos, African djembe, darbuka, and many other hand drums. I'll play a tune one day a certain way, and then the next week I'll play it different because I hear something different. I hear notes within the note. Movements are the same way. They start out one way, and then over time, they evolve into something else. So what we're doing today might not be what the people want to do 3, 4, 5 months from now because things evolve.
Right.
You know, and so that is how I would characterize that. And I'm quite sure that in the future, the people on Guard Street and in many parts of Hartford will evolve into something else where what we're doing might not even be necessary.
Right. I guess that's what I was trying to get at. Like, not that you would give up the
ethos or politics of the
philosophy behind armed self-defense. It's just that you're hoping that if you can get through this period, use these tactics that you're using now, maybe you won't need to use them in the future. These sort of organized marches, like
I agree with that 100%. That there will come a time when people like me are no longer needed. We'll be looked upon as being part of the antediluvian period, you know, like dinosaurs. And that's fine. And I understand historically that things change and times change and people move on. Ideas move on. But for right now, here in space and time, this is what people is focusing on. And if they come to me one day and say, Cornell, listen, we want to thank you for what you've done. We're going to move on to something else. I would not be offended. I would get out the way and I would wait to see what they came up with, because I understand this is the way of social movements. And all things change from something strange to something new. And I look forward to seeing how this evolves in the future.
Okay. But for the time being, as things are now, you're going to continue these marches. Where can people find out more about you and the Self-Defense Brigade if they're interested in joining or helping?
We have a Facebook page called Self-Defense Brigade. You can go there to get more information. People can also contact me on Facebook, and I'll have somebody contact them. Let me just say that people who do contact us, we decide to work with them. We will work with them according to what they feel they can do. See, people like me and other people will go into a cave and kill a dragon. Some people are not going to do that. But there are people who can sharpen up the sword. You can do that. You can help recruit people. You can help show up at marches. You can solicit money so we can buy equipment for other things. Not everybody has to be on the front lines. And we understand that. And so we assess people, their willingness to get involved, whether they have a job or not, whether they have children, whether they have physical problems or cognitive issues. In a war, in a social movement, there's a place for everybody. If we work as a mechanism, we can pull this off. So we're not going to just get anybody and throw them out there and say, okay, we're going to run headlong into the lion's den. Not everybody's made like that. And I understand that. The people like myself will do the rough work. The other people can do other things that make sure that we are successful when we go out. So contact me on Facebook. Contact the Self-Defense Brigade on the Self-Defense Brigade page, and then we'll have somebody contact you, and then we'll see how you fit in. And everybody has a place. And we have all kinds of people that help us out front and behind the scenes.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your perspective with us and giving us some insight into your operation. We really appreciate it. We're going to head over to our news update now.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the weekly news update. I'm contributing writer Jake Fogelman, joined as always by Reload founder Stephen Gutowski. How are we doing this week, Steve?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you, Jake?
Doing pretty good. You know, maybe listeners that don't follow Colorado might not know, but we just survived a snowpocalypse.
Right.
Downtown Denver, where I'm at, we only got about 9 inches, but parts of the state got over 4 feet of snow in a day. So that's pretty crazy.
Well, did you take advantage at all?
Like, I worked from home, if you consider that taking advantage of it. I didn't go into my office.
No, I don't. I work from home every day, so that's not not a big perk as going out into the fresh powder and skiing or snowboarding.
Yeah, unfortunately, it was like very heavy, wet, slushy kind of snow that fell. So like we had a lot of trees go down, and so it wasn't really great skiing or snowboarding snow, just kind of enough to be annoying for everybody.
I don't know. When does your winter actually end out there?
In Colorado, it's kind of schizophrenic the way the weather works. March is our heaviest precipitation month, even as the temperatures get warmer. So it's kind of, we're in that weird limbo space right now. But we've gotten snow as late as June some years.
Oh my gosh. That's crazy. Yeah, we're in that like fluctuating season too here in Virginia, where it goes back and forth between cold and I think it actually snowed not long ago here at night. And now it's in the 70s. So typical stuff. We're almost at the cherry blossom peak week, right? That's when everybody goes to the mall and looks at the trees, which I'll probably be doing with my girlfriend here this weekend. So, but of course, it's going to be freezing cold right after that. So might be a shorter peak than usual because the trees might not make it through the freezing temperatures that come up. But we'll see. It should be nice. It should be nice soon here. But anyway, what do we got in terms of headlines?
Sure. So from the newsletter, we got an interesting story out of the Center Square, mostly coming from Professor James Allen Fox, who we've had on the show before. And he's reported out that mass gun violence, which he's using the gun violence archive sort of definition of public shootings where four or more people are shot.
Yeah, the broader definition. Yeah.
Right. And it's interesting. He said it's down 48% so far. Which is a pretty big deal. And his criticism is it's not getting as much attention as obviously when those numbers tick up.
Yeah.
But it's still a pretty big result, pretty stark drop in that sort of, big public display of violence.
Absolutely. And actually, to this point, we haven't had any mass shootings that qualify for the gun violence archive definition, which is the stricter definition than I think what more people would think of when they think of a mass shooting. But, four or more people killed in a act in public. And so there haven't been any of those as of recording, which we're recording on Friday, March 15th. Obviously the problem with these events is that they can be fairly random, right? So there's no way of telling if this is going to be a continuing trend or if we might have a terrible incident later today. And I think that's one of the things, if you go back and listen to our interview with James Allen Fox, from a couple of years ago, that's one of the things he pointed out, this sort of idea that there's sort of a mean number of these events each year, and whatever clustering that might happen there is not as significant as a lot of people make it out to be. So you'll get periods where there aren't any shootings like we've had at the beginning of this year, and then you'll get periods where there are several right in a row, and it's not necessarily because of any specific singular cause. We'll have to have him back on though. I think it's because it's obviously a very positive trend to see not having these big mass shootings at the beginning of the year. If you go back to 2022, it was like that up until, March 15th and was the first one that year, I think March 14th. And there have been a couple other years, if you look through Professor Fox's database, where you haven't had a public mass shooting where four or more are killed through the first several months of the year. The fact that the GBA numbers, that broader definition, are down too is also interesting because, we know, we've talked about it, we've reported on it, that last year there was a significant drop in murder across the United States. We had that surge during the during and in the immediate aftermath of the pandemic, where murder rate went way above what it had been for the previous 20 years or so. And last year we saw that come back down to earth, closer to what the pre-pandemic rates were, not quite there yet to the 2018, 2019 levels, but the largest single drop in the murder rate in a year, I believe, is what we saw last year. So at the same time, you're still getting those GBA mass shooting numbers rising, which is fascinating. And you still had 8 mass shootings that hit that violence project definition, which is in line with the highs that we had seen the last couple of years too. So that you hadn't seen that same effect on mass attacks that you had on the overall murder rate. And now maybe we're seeing it this year going into the beginning of 2024 here. So I don't know, I'd like to have Professor Fox back on the show and maybe talk about this more in detail. Hopefully he can join us maybe next week.
Yeah, no, that'd be great for him to give us some more context on why he thinks these shootings are going down, at least. And then the last couple of links we're going to talk about deal with actually your home state and my home state. So first, out of Virginia, obviously they had quite a busy legislative session on gun control bills. And a lot of people were watching to see what Governor Youngkin was going to do, since he's the Republican governor and both chambers of the Virginia legislature are Democrats. And he's acted actually on the first pair, or I think 3 bills he's acted on, gun control bills anyway, that have been sent to his desk, including vetoing 2 of them. So that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, he vetoed 2 and then he sent one back with recommendations. This was one about informing parents of the risks of guns, I guess. And he sent it back with a recommendation that they add a bunch of other things to inform parents of, like their rights to challenge curriculum in school, things of that nature. And so we'll see what the legislature does with that. But yeah, it's an interesting dynamic right now in Virginia. One of the most interesting, I think, across the country, because Democrats have a very slim majority in the House and Senate here. And obviously the governor, Glenn Youngkin, is a Republican. And you've seen nearly uniform voting patterns from each party, where the Democrats have sent like 40 gun bills to the governor's desk, and almost all of them passed on party lines. There were maybe 1 or 2. There were a couple that you had a single Republican senator join in on. These were some of the less strict gun control measures, but you had the Democratic Party in Virginia voting complete lockstep with each other on this issue and for the more extreme measures, the stricter gun control measures that you could have. I mean, there's assault weapons ban being the most obvious example of that, but also these sort of broom response type bills. We have restrictions like that coming through, restrictions on where you can get gun safety training for your concealed carry permit. There is just a slew of new restrictions that every Democrat has voted for, which is pretty remarkable, and which it seems the governor is likely to veto all of them. He has not. Now, look, we've reported this before on the show, but we reached out to his office and they told us that they didn't have a specific position on every bill, but that they stood by the governor's state of the state address, where he said he believes Virginia already has among the strictest gun laws in the country. Because his predecessor had signed universal background checks and a number of gun-free zone restrictions, local gun-free zone restrictions, into law in the previous session before he became governor, and a red flag law. So Virginia already is somewhere in the middle on this issue compared to a lot of other states that are, either more red or more blue, right? So Virginia's already kind of in the middle, but the governor is signaling that he's not necessarily going to sign any of these things. Maybe some of the more minor ones we'll have to see. But I also talked to a source who has worked in Virginia politics, and that was essentially their take as well, that the governor's unlikely to sign any of the major reforms. So But to me, I think the political dynamics are the most interesting thing going on in Virginia on guns right now, with especially with the Democratic Party being completely in line with everyone voting for all of these new restrictions. You didn't see any dissension there. And even on the Republican side, you really only saw a single senator move in favor of any of these bills, and not the more headline grabbing ones. So pretty fascinating. What's going on with Colorado? I imagine they're kind of a similar situation there. You got a lot of bills coming through.
Yeah, I was going to say, it seems like Colorado and Virginia in particular were the two states that decided this year was going to be go for broke time for more gun bills. Colorado is a little bit different dynamic. It's not quite as narrowly divided. Actually, Democrats have more control of the state government than they've had in decades. And they're taking advantage of it they have 10 bills so far introduced, including some headline grabbing ones like an assault weapon ban, the sort of copycat brew and response style bill from California that I've covered before and we've talked about on the show before. Plus a bunch of other, insurance requirements, gun credit card tracking codes, you name it. Like, it's a very long list of gun control bill wish list type items. The fact that they've made, Colorado, we've talked about, has been sort of the bright spot of the gun control movement over the last decade. They've gone from a D rating from the gun groups to now an A- rating in Gifford's last report. And yet there's still 10 more bills that they want to pursue this year. So that'll be one to watch. None of them have made it to the governor's desk just yet. But I think Colorado will again be a state to watch for sort of the trend in gun control politics.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And that's probably going to stay that way, because I don't think Colorado's politics are moving in a different direction at this point. Although it has been interesting to see the governor there avoiding assault weapons ban, right? Even though there's some resurgence for that in gun control politics lately.
I'll say the sources I've spoken to, again, don't think that he's on board with this renewed assault weapon ban effort. Same thing that happened last year. So, there's no way of knowing for sure whether or not this is going to go anywhere. But based on how this one was introduced, and it doesn't look like the governor's changed his mind on this, I don't think the assault weapon ban one will become law. Some of the other ones, though, are sort of, wild cards. I think most of them will probably pass and be signed. Maybe the Bruin response bill could also be another one that he might try to be a moderating voice on, but we just don't know.
Yeah, and I think another point for Youngkin in Virginia to the direction that he's not going to sign the vast majority of these gun bills is that Democrats in the legislature had tried to use one of his marquee issues to get him to compromise on and sign some of these bills that they want on the gun issue, and that was the stadium funding. The governor wants to move the Washington Capitals and Wizards to Virginia. He wants to put them in Northern Virginia, near the Pentagon. And, the Democrats have torpedoed that plan, and had initially tried to use it as a bargaining chip to get some of these gun bills through. And so, now that plan's dead, and at least from all appearances on the outside, it's dead. And I think that's probably a good indication that you aren't going to see Youngkin sign any significant gun bills. But Virginia and Colorado, definitely a lot going on. Maybe not a lot ending up in law in Virginia, but the politics there are pretty fascinating and maybe representative of where we are as a country on the issue, where at this point, you don't really have any Democrats left in Virginia that are dissenting on even the most radical, the furthest left policy positions on guns. They're all pretty much in agreement. And that comes even after, 2020, where you saw a huge protest movement throughout the entire state that culminated in a giant protest at the Capitol. That also resulted in Democrats, even just 4 years ago, there were four senators four Democratic senators that blocked the assault weapons ban from being passed at that time. And now I think most of them aren't in office anymore. And nobody on the Democratic side voted against the assault weapons ban that was proposed this time. So interesting change in that party at this point.
Certainly. And we'll keep an eye on both of the states going forward to see what becomes of these bills in the end. But heading into some of the stories we wrote this week, you had an interesting one out of California. Their Department of Justice, headed by obviously their Attorney General Rob Bonta, just released their Armed and Prohibited Persons Systems report, basically documenting all the folks that they know have guns, and for whatever reason, whether they're convicted of felonies or they have a mental illness prohibition or restraining order prohibition, who they have documented as having those firearms despite their status, and who they've taken guns, you know, from in that instance. And you reported some interesting numbers from that report.
Yeah, so they've released these people that they suspect have guns that shouldn't have them, based on the factors that you just mentioned. And so they have a long list of these people, and they removed 9,000 or so people from the list, and they only added about 8,000 back to it, or a little, I think it's like more like 8,500 back to the list of new people that they suspect shouldn't have guns that they shouldn't. And so that, you know, they're making some modest progress on cutting down the backlog that they have in this database, which they've had around since 2006, and have actually only rarely made significant progress in cutting through the backlog. And also, you know, I guess it should be noted that they removed 9,000 people from the list. They only actually recovered about 1,400 guns. So presumably there are a number of other ways you can be removed from the list. One, like your restraining order expires, or your parole expires, or they make contact with you and they're assured that you don't actually have the gun that you previously bought. Because remember, in California, they have a gun registry. So at least in theory, they know who owns guns. And then they know if you've been convicted of some crime or done something to trigger a prohibition. And that's how this list gets put together, right? And so this year was a relatively successful one for them in terms of cutting down the list. I mean, they only made, the list was cut down by about 1.75%. So not huge progress. They still have about 24,000 people on this list of suspected prohibited possessors. But this was actually a positive report in there for the state, because a lot of years they don't actually cut down the list at all, and they add more people than they're able to verify shouldn't be on it, or whose guns they've confiscated. And so, you know, that kind of goes to the point that I've got in a members piece that I'm working on right now, which is, you know, I think this is sort of your best case scenario for a gun confiscation program, because you're targeting people who most Americans agree shouldn't have guns, you know, convicted felons. I mean, there's some controversies on these things, obviously, nonviolent felons being one area where there's a lot of court cases on that, or domestic violence restraining orders. That's, you know, one of the cases at the Supreme Court right now, whether that's the constitutional restriction. But for the, by and large, most Americans agree with these, that the people that are on this list, most of them probably shouldn't be allowed to have guns. And so you got a relatively uncontroversial group of people to be disarmed, I guess, is just the base level point I'm trying to make there. And you also are in a state where they register all the guns. So they, in theory, know at least most people who own guns, and they can match them up, as they're trying to do with this program, of people who've done something that means they can't own guns anymore, and people who have previously bought guns. And you have information about where those people live, at least when they bought the guns or when they were arrested or what have you. And so in theory, there's a pretty straightforward way of just go and make contact with these people, and if they still have their guns, confiscate them, right? So sort of a best case scenario for a gun confiscation program. And they're still not doing a very good job. I guess is the bottom line here. They still have about 24,000 people on this list. You know, of course, this list is only, according to the state, according to this report, it's less than 1% of all gun owners in California. So it's not a very large number of people relative to the entire state's population of gun owners. This is another thing. Like, they're not only is a list of people that most Americans don't think should have guns, but it's also a pretty small list compared to the number of people who actually have guns, and those are the people who've gone through the legal process to get them, right? And So it just kind of underscores how difficult a mass confiscation program would actually be in real life, you know, to the point where it's wildly impractical. You know, this is 24,000 people, and they still have trouble even modestly reducing that number after years. This program's been in place almost 20 years. And if you look at the details, most of the people still on the list, they are basically cold cases where they have no further leads, where they've tried to investigate and find these folks and figure out if they still have guns or take away the guns if they do have them and haven't been able to. So, you know, even with the scenario where you're going after people that most would agree shouldn't have guns, it's still very hard, even in a state like California, where there's a lot more resources dedicated to something like this. This is one of the only states that does this kind of program at all. And you know, of course, the difficulty of taking people's guns is only going to increase as you get further away from the point where people agree somebody shouldn't have guns, right? So if you just try to go after every gun owner in California, well, that's millions of people, not a couple, you know, 10,000, 20,000 or whatever. And then if you go to the rest of the country, I mean, was 47% of the country reports having a gun in the home, 52% of voters report having a gun in the home at this point. Those are two different polls, the AP and NBC, but you get the idea. About half the country has a gun. That's 100, 120, 130 million American households. And, you know, it's just not feasible. There's something like the Small Arms Survey estimates about 400 million guns, and that was back in 2018. I think the more modern estimates, and that the Trace has done an estimate that used ATF manufacturing data and puts the number closer to 500 million. And, you know, the California program has confiscated 1,400 guns. You know, it's just not that there's obviously no risk. There's no way that you could boost the program if you spend a lot more money on trying to round up these guns. I just think it gives you an example of here's the best case scenario you could think of for a program of confiscating firearms. And it still struggles mightily. And I think there's the implications of that is just another example of why mass gun confiscation wouldn't work in real life.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting point. And Reload members should definitely go check out that piece because it'll be live by the time this podcast is live. So Reload members should go check it out. Then you have another interesting piece this week about a court case coming out of a criminal law case, actually, dealing with the federal prohibition on illegal immigrants possessing firearms. And there was a judge that actually dismissed a case against a person under the standard because she said, as applied to this person, that prohibition was unconstitutional. If you want to tell us a little bit about the ruling.
Yeah, pretty interesting ruling. In fact, I think this was from an Obama appointee. So, you know, going against what I think a lot of people expect a judge to rule one way or the other based on whoever appointed them. And I think it's important to note that that's not always the case. But yeah, they ruled essentially the person who had been charged in this case was just charged for simple possession of a gun, no other crimes on their record beyond entering the country illegally or being in the country illegally. Which is not even a felony. It's a misdemeanor crime, and it's certainly not a crime of violence. You know, it's a nonviolent crime. And this person had no record of violent criminal activity, and so the judge found there was, you know, in line with Range, for instance, another case we've covered a lot in the Third Circuit Court of Appeals, where you know the person who had been convicted of food stamp fraud, essentially, you know, lying about their income to get food stamps. Which was qualified as a felony, even though it was a state misdemeanor, you know, that they can't be barred from owning guns because their crime was nonviolent and they aren't dangerous. And so this judge used a very similar standard in her case. She had actually initially back in 2022, before the Supreme Court's Bruin case, Bruin decision was handed down with the new standard for how to judge Second Amendment cases, it actually ruled against this defendant. But then now, in light of the ruling and the subsequent appeals court rulings that question these sort of nonviolent convictions leading to permanent loss of gun rights, that basically this case needed to be revisited, and she found in favor of the undocumented immigrant. So, pretty interesting and wide reaching potentially ruling here. One that also caused a bit of controversy. You know, it's first of all, it adds to that debate among lower court judges that you've sort of talked about last week with what standard works for these various federal prohibitions on gun ownership or gun possession, and how the Supreme Court is probably going to have to step in pretty soon to clear up some of these things. I think yours was specifically about felon in possession, but the questions are pretty similar here, even with the prohibition on illegal immigrants owning guns, even though it's not a felony technically for somebody to stay in the country, you know, overstay their visa or what have you, be here without legal status. I think it adds to that urgency for the court to take up a case and start to explain its view of how these things should be decided, or at least further explain it. Obviously, Bruin itself laid out a whole test, but we haven't gotten anything beyond that from the court yet. But this also started a debate among gun rights advocates. You had Larry Keene from the National Shooting Sports Foundation question the ruling based on the concept that the right of the people to keep and bear arms should not be infringed. It only applies to basically people in the community, the political community. This is something you've heard in a number of other cases as well. The government has argued this a number of times, including in Range, where it was rejected. But the idea that historically there were sort of groups outside of the political community, outside of the people of the United States. And, there's some argument that includes non-citizens or people who are not legally allowed to be here. But there was pushback on that from, there was actually a whole back and forth from a number of gun rights lawyers who sort of hotly debated this question, including Costas Moros, who we've had on the show and has written for us analysis pieces for us in the past. And then Matt Larisori, who's I think better known as Fudbusters online, but Matt chimed in as well, criticizing Larry's take, and him and Costas went back and forth on this. It's in the piece, but I also actually have them, they've agreed to write something for us, laying out their positions, which I think it's going to be interesting for people to read that. And I think it's sort of a core part of this overall debate in the wake of Bruin on how to look at these historical laws and what they actually mean and how they should be, analogized to modern prohibitions. So I'm looking forward to seeing what those guys have to say. And of course, we'll publish that for you once we have them with us. And I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, no, it should be fascinating. And it's a very interesting question, not only because just who can be disarmed has been a hotly contested area of Second Amendment jurisprudence, but this question in particular, illegal immigration, has all sorts of cross-cutting political cleavages. And so I think it should be a fascinating debate, and people should definitely check out those two pieces.
Yeah. And then you actually have a piece on another magazine ban being upheld and some of the implications of that.
Yeah. So we had a big ruling out of the First Circuit, the Boston-based Federal Appeals Court, essentially upholding Rhode Island's ban on magazines that hold more than 10 rounds. That's how they define their large capacity magazine ban. And it's, pretty in line with a lot of the hard, quote unquote, hardware ban cases. So things like assault, quote unquote, assault weapon bans and magazine bans. There's sort of been this coalescing of judges that uphold these laws around a particular reading of the Bruin test, where they say, sure, we'll grant you that there's no direct analog to the founding era of hardware bans. But Bruin instructs us that things like unprecedented societal concerns brought about by dramatic technological changes allow us to do a more nuanced approach to history, allows us to analogize more loosely over a broader period of time, or so they say. And so they tend to bring things like the Bowie knife bans that were fairly common in the country in the late 19th century, so the late 1800s. Even things like the National Firearms Act, when we crack down on short-barreled rifles, sawed-off shotguns, machine guns, that sort of thing. And they say that's
that just demonstrates from the 1930s. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. We're getting into the 20th century in a lot of these cases. But they say that demonstrates a tradition of basically governments responding to new innovations in weaponry that lead to some, you know, murder or some organized crime in the case of the National Firearms Act. Yeah. And that demonstrates a tradition that allows you to then look at modern AR-15s or magazines and say that we can ban those as well. So certainly interesting. Obviously, gun rights people have a problem, I think, with that. You see a lot of criticism saying that that's, you know, you're misreading Bruin or you're making a mockery of Bruin by drawing on all these late non-founding era analogies, or you're interest balancing by another, by other means.
But the bigger problem here, which you touched on a lot in your, it was sort of the core of your member piece, your analysis on this, this whole situation. Cause you're right. Like, this has been the go-to, justification for upholding a lot of these hardware bans, and it's become commonplace in these cases. And one of the issues is that these cases all take place in the same types of jurisdictions, right? The same circuits. And that's because they are the circuits that oversee the states that have these laws. There's not that many states that have these laws, and they're sort of geographically isolated from elsewhere. You know, they're more liberal states, and they produce more liberal circuits because of how the federal court system works, right? I mean, there's the home state, you know, people from the circuits get to nominate judges in a lot of cases. There've been a lot of, like, senators from those states have more say in who gets appointed to those circuits. And so there's, it's created this kind of geographical trap, I guess, for gun rights proponents, right? Is that, that's sort of
what you're sort of caught between a rock and a hard place, because this standard for upholding hardware bans has become almost so commonplace. And because, like you said, there's only about a dozen or so states with assault weapon bans / magazine bans where these challenges could even theoretically take place, you're sort of very limited in where these challenges can go. And they're going to all the same judges that all use the same standard. So it's almost like, you know, they're going to lose every time. And we've seen that and reflected in many of these federal court rulings that hardware bans aren't being struck down in most cases. So they pretty much have to rely on the Supreme Court one of these days. We don't know when. We've covered the fact that so far they've shown hesitance to, you know, take up assault weapon ban cases. Until that happens, it seems like that trend is going to continue, where it's just going to be, this is the standard, we're going to go with this more nuanced approach, and hardware bans are allowed to stay.
Right. And of course, without circuit splits, because a lot of the circuits dealing with these things all seem to be fairly well in agreement on this justification that you're talking about, that makes it less likely for the court to take it up, or at least makes it a less urgent issue, especially with all the other things that are there teed up to take, like these felon in possession bans, challenges to those. So I don't know. It's interesting. And I think it is, you know, that is obviously not the only way this court can take up a case. It could decide to take up an assault weapons case, especially if it finds that this justification is as bad as gun rights advocates say it is, right? The court can itself go in and take this case, which is kind of what Bruin was to some extent, right? A lot of Bruin is just complaining about the lower courts and how they have, how Google has decided to turn itself on. Lovely. But sorry about that. Yeah. So, you know, we'll see what the court does. They I think, will be the ultimate. I mean, they always have the ultimate say, but it's whether they get involved or how fast they get involved, I think, is the bigger question. You know, Bruin was a lot of complaining about the lower courts not doing what they wanted, but it didn't happen until, 14 years after Heller was handed down. So,
right.
Yeah. you know, that's the big, that's another issue that the gun rights advocates complain about. And we'll see what the court does this time around. But yeah, we'll have to keep all that in mind, and we're going to obviously stay focused on it. But for now, we actually have a member segment, one of my favorites. So we're going to head over to that. All right. It's time for one of my favorite segments, our member segment. We have with us another Reload member this week, Wayne Lurch. Welcome to the show, Wayne. I appreciate you taking some time out to come on and have just a little discussion with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, these segments are designed to give us a little bit of insight into Reload membership and what folks are like and some of the different backgrounds and points of view that we have here from our paying members, people that make the Reload possible, that support our work. And so, yeah, well, can you just give us a little bit, just a quick introduction, just a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I live in D.C., actually relatively new to owning firearms, and I have my own business. I'm a home inspector in the Washington metropolitan area, and I'm also a RSO at a local gun range.
Oh, wonderful. And how a little bit about your background. When you were growing up, where are you from, first of all, and did you have any experience with firearms?
So I'm a native Washingtonian. There are not a whole lot of us around. And I remember as a young kid, my father taking us to, I think, somebody's backyard gun range and, you know, being able to shoot a handgun. And that was it until after I graduated from high school, where some buddies of mine and I, we went out to a local skeet trap range out in Greenbelt, Maryland, and I shot trap, really enjoyed it, was actually not bad at it either. So went there a couple times, but then didn't touch guns until, 3-4 years ago.
Interesting. That's actually how I got into shooting as well, is with skeet shooting in a sort of backyard setting after college. But so your experience with it, but then you weren't into the sport for a while. You didn't own guns until just recently, right? What happened? Right. There?
So in the mid late teens, when things started, well, up until recently, relatively recently, I couldn't own a handgun in D.C. Until the Heller decision, and I thought about it. But it was convoluted and not easy to get a gun at that time. Actually, the only FFL at the time was in the police department. So there's apparently a guy in the police department that was the FFL.
And actually he retired in 2020. Yeah. I remember this whole ordeal. And so for a while, literally the only licensed firearms dealer in Washington, D.C. was the actual police department, itself, which created a lot of issues, but they did eventually find people to come in and replace them, which is probably a good thing. Now there's two for the whole city, which,
But luckily for me,
and no actual gun stores either.
Exactly. Yeah. But luckily for me, the first FFL outside of the police department had come on just when I bought my first gun. What happened was that I was a bike race official for USA Cycling. And a couple of guys that I officiated with were into guns. And while I was never anti-gun, I'm a liberal, have been my entire life. I was pro-gun control. And in talking to my friends, realized that I was wrong. They were reasonable people. I think I'm a reasonable person. We listened to each other, listened to our arguments, and it changed my opinion. And as things started to get a little crazy for me, in the teens, as a gay man, I got worried about my safety in the district. So I decided to get a gun. I was going to get a gun for self-protection. And the target shoot, because I remembered it being fun. Well, I found out how much fun it really is. I've been buying guns on a regular. I'm actually on a first name basis with a lot of the people at the police department from registering guns. Maybe a little too often. And, you know, I'm nice, they're nice. So we have a nice relationship. But I got my CCW. And in doing that and believing that if I'm going to carry a firearm, I have to be well-trained. So I took classes with shooting at least once a week to become proficient. And in doing that and seeing how some people act in gun ranges and their lack of safety considerations and complaining to the management, they decide to bring on
public RSAs. Ranges.
Yeah.
Public ranges with no RSAs can be a, you can have some concerns there sometimes, right?
Yeah. So they, you know, what I loved about that range and why I was shooting there is because they listen. A, they're really friendly, and B, listen to people. You know, if you have a good idea, they're going to listen. And then they asked me if I wanted to become an RSO. So be careful what you ask for.
Right. You were concerned about the safety, and they said, all right, well, you should become an RSO and help us out then.
And that kind of feeds right into basically – I was a safety PO when I was in the Navy. I'm a home inspector, and one of my big focuses is safety. So that kind of fits right into my personality. So I got certification and been an RSO for a couple of years now.
Nice. Yeah. You know, one of the interesting things about that whole story there, the timeline is to me is part of it. Is pretty common, right? It's a pretty common thing to hear, right? People get, maybe they get concerned about their safety. And so they're like, all right, I should buy a gun for just in case I need one or, you know, what have you. And so the self-defense aspect might be the primary motivator. Mm-hmm. But then when you get the gun and you go shooting, one of the things I think is commonly underrated or under-discussed, especially in major media, when you're talking about firearms ownership, is the enjoyable aspect of it. People might go out and buy a gun because they want to be able to protect themselves, which does get, a lot of discussion. But once they do that, they find a lot of them, at least, find that it's fun. I mean, shooting, target shooting is fun. Working on guns can be fun if you like mechanical things, building guns, teaching people. As an instructor or a safety officer can be an enjoyable experience as well for a lot of people. And that's one thing I take away from what you're saying here. You might have had that safety, personal, safety motivation, but then you also just really liked shooting and
it's a lot of thing.
Collecting firearms.
And I've gotten into competition. I'm shooting USPSA now. Falling steel competition. Yeah, I'm not great at it, but it is a blast. I mean, and the camaraderie is just, I mean, it's amazing the diversity of people who shoot guns. It's not just a bunch of old white guys, but it's incredibly diverse. And I love that aspect of it and completely different people from completely different political persuasions and backgrounds who want nothing more than to help each other get better and impart information. So that's another thing about the community that really appeals to me.
Absolutely. I think the most diverse thing that I do as a hobby is shooting. I like all kinds of stuff, and there's plenty of diversity in a lot of it. Sports, there's different sports I like, but hockey, and I enjoy snowboarding and stuff like things like that nature. But when you go to the range, you're going to see a much wider variety, especially here in Northern Virginia, where I am, or in DC, the ranges that you're going to, which wouldn't be in DC because it doesn't have any ranges, but in the metro area, are going to be very, very diverse clientele at those places, much more so than, the Ski Mountain or what have you. So it is, I think, another underrated aspect to all of this. So you mentioned, obviously that you're a liberal and, that you, how does that interact with your gun ownership? How do you view that? We've interviewed people from all sorts of different political backgrounds here on the show, especially the membership, but but also, you know, you're seeing sort of a rise in liberal gun owners. We have the liberal gun club is one major example of that. But they're not the only ones, of course.
Right.
You know, how do you see the, I guess, the political side of all this?
So I think that gun ownership and gun rights fits in perfectly with being a liberal, that everybody should have the right to protect themselves. And whether you like it or not, guns, handguns particularly, are the easiest or the most common way to protect oneself because they are concealable. In a home, while I much prefer to have a rifle, a handgun is probably much more practical, particularly in a small a house or apartment. Also, you know, it's like one of my problems with gun control is that the people it hurts the most are the people who need it the most, which are poor people, people in areas that are underserved by transportation. We were, you know, as discussing earlier, the fact that you can't take a firearm on public transportation in the District of Columbia really does limit.
Even if you have a permit.
Even if you have a permit, it makes it very difficult for people from underserved areas or more dangerous areas to protect themselves. So protecting those who have less, I think, fits in perfectly with a liberal mindset.
And so speaking of, I guess, the politics of this, you know, the Reload here, we cover policy and politics and culture, firearms. How did you come across the Reload? What made you want to become a member?
So when I was first thinking about getting a gun, same thing when I bought a motorcycle or was going to get a motorcycle, I used YouTube to, you know, scare myself and to learn how to protect myself with what is a dangerous item. Motorcycles, you have to ride them like you think everybody's trying to kill you because, well, they may not intentionally be doing it, but that's what they're doing. Same thing with handguns or firearms. So I started watching a lot of YouTube videos, and I realized there are some people who I shouldn't listen to, but a lot of people I should. And I also got some suggestions from people who I know and trust. And I can't remember which channel it was that you were on where I saw you. And it was like, oh, my God, somebody who's talking about firearms without all the hyperbole. You know, you give me some information and let me make my decisions or, you know, come up with my own idea. So that's how I found you. It's a nice breath of fresh air for me to be able to get some, you know, just information, you know, and that's all. That's what I want from any news source. So that's how I found you, and I've been a member ever since.
Oh, well, that's wonderful. And yeah, I mean, that's we try to take that sober, serious approach so people can make up their own minds about these things. You know, I do my best to give my analysis. I do my best not to make it just my opinion of what things should be, but my analysis of what things are, if that may, hopefully that I know that distinction can be, there can be a thin line there and you gotta be, I'm always trying to be aware of that and careful of it. But, but yeah, that's what I try to bring. And I think Jake does the same thing in his pieces. And obviously we've had writers, other writers who've contributed that I think take that same approach. So, I'm glad, always glad to hear that's what's resonating with folks. And of course, super appreciative that, you know, you've decided to be a member who supports the work we're doing, because it wouldn't be possible without the paid membership. Like, we try to keep a lot of our news stuff free so it can get out to the most people as possible and help inform as many people as possible. And but also have that balance of having, you know, member exclusive pieces or perks like this member segment, so that you guys get a real value out of your membership as well. And hopefully we're making that balance enough that it's attractive for people. Yeah. I really appreciate you taking the time to come on and give us a little bit of your backstory. Now everybody is eager to go out in public and talk about stuff like this, especially with how political it can be. So I always appreciate it when members are willing to come on.
Yeah. It's funny. I was looking forward to doing this, but it's like there is nothing on my social media, nothing on my card that suggests I have firearms. Because my thing is, if I ever have to use a gun in self-defense, knock on wood, I never do. I don't want a prosecutor going on to my social media and saying, look, he's this fanatic. Yeah.
Right. So, well, I don't think you come off as a fanatic in this.
I don't want anything on my card that says, come break my window. I have something in here you want.
Right. Absolutely. Of course. But look, we appreciate you taking a little bit of time and giving us some insight into your personal story and some further insight into our community here at The Reload. If anybody else out there wants to join The Reload and become part of the membership and maybe appear on the show in the member segment like this, they can head over to thereload.com and pick up a membership today. We've got monthly and yearly options. And of course, in addition to supporting our work, you'll get access to hundreds of pieces of exclusive analysis and reporting that you won't find anywhere else. You'll get the podcast a day early and an opportunity to appear on the show. But that's all we've got for this week. And we'll see you guys again real soon.